Good morning. This is Friday the 21st of September and I'm here to interview Rosa Sacran. Rosa, would you like to start off by telling me when you were born, where you were born and your name at birth?
I was born in Berlin, in Germany, on the 23rd of March 1925.
And were you an only child or did you have siblings?
I was the youngest of three. My sister, Betty, was the oldest. My brother was the middle one. And then I was always 2 years between us.
And what was life like when you were a young child growing up in Berlin?
Well, I wouldn't say that there was anything unusual, except the environment I lived in was a very Jewish one and a politically very active environment. And even as a very small child, I was very much aware of the problems at the time. People tend to think that Germany in the early periods was a democracy, where people could virtually do what they wanted, but in fact it wasn't. There was a constant struggle between the communists and the National Socialists already in the 20s. So I was very much aware of the problems.
In what way were you aware?
Well, because there were constant fights, and also because my uncles, and in a way my father too, seemed to be very much involved with what was going on. We used to have police coming to the house looking for material or any adverse material against the government. So I was very much aware of problems and difficulties. I also remember that there was a curfew imposed in our area primarily because of all these fights which were going on. And we were not allowed to go out. Our windows had to be shut. And I was a very young child at the time. And I wanted to know what was going on, because we had police standing on either side of our street, not just with revolvers, but with guns. So I opened the window and I heard this voice shouting, "Shut that window or we will shoot." So my mother came running in, knew exactly who was responsible, and quickly took me away, said, "Do you want us all to be shot?" But that is what I saw, and I was about 5 years old. So I understood a lot of problems that actually emanated both from the political situation and the purely social and physical situation.
And were your parents employed at that time? Were they in employment?
My father, by that time already, had his own business. He had a small manufacturing business. He was a master tailor. And he employed 20 people in his works, but also had home workers. And he was a staunch trade unionist. And I remember when we visited him in his factory premises, the first thing he insisted upon was that we went to each one of the workers and wished them a good day. My sister was okay, she did that, but I wouldn't do it. I thought, this is stupid. I don't go up to these people, make my curtsy and say, "Good day." And I think he found that very difficult. He didn't know how to handle me. And eventually, see, I really wanted to play.
Of course.
I wasn't interested in going up and saying hello to people. And then he said to me, "Otherton, Do you see all these workers working very hard? It is because of them that you have bread on the table. And in my little mind, I understood what he was saying. I looked round and I went to each one of them, made my curtsy and wished them a good day.
And did he employ Jewish and non-Jewish workers? Did that enter into it?
I think there were mainly non-Jewish workers. I couldn't say for sure because I didn't really know sufficiently about it, but I think they were mainly non-Jewish.
And did you live in a Jewish area in Berlin?
Yes, we did.
So would that be similar to other Jewish communities, that everybody knew what everybody else was up to?
Not quite, because it was a very large area,
right.
And it was a mixed area. I mean, although Jews lived there, but there were lots of non-Jews there as well. So it wasn't a question of us being in either, what do you call it, in excess.
Mm-hmm.
And the non-Jews were sort of subjugated,
right.
Nothing like that.
No. Was it a traditional Jewish area?
Oh, yes.
So,
but I think there were variations there. I think,
right.
Certainly my family was Orthodox, but my father was already moving away from it.
Mm-hmm.
But I had, my great-grandfather evidently was a Talmudist.
Right. Would you like to explain what a Talmudist is?
Pardon?
A Talmudist is.
A Talmudist is a man who was very knowledgeable in what the Talmud actually represented and what it said. And people, of course, came to him for any questions to be solved.
Mm-hmm.
This is basically what Talmudists
mm-hmm.
did. It's not that they created something new, but they had studied it and they knew it in depth.
And they would be very respected as well.
Oh, very much so, mm-hmm. yes.
And so did you keep Shabbat?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, we were an Orthodox home.
So how did you leave Berlin?
Pardon?
How did you come to leave Berlin? Did you come over on
yes,
the...
Yes, I think... Well, no. The reason why I left... My father was arrested in 1935. And there was a big trial. And there were about 200 Jewish men who were arrested and put on trial. And each one of these men had offended the Nuremberg laws. And each one of these men were imprisoned. So that meant that my own life, my own family, became very dislocated. But not only that, as part of the punishment was that they virtually deprived him of all his funds. So we were really very poor at that time, but we were quite comfortable. At this point, my mother was really left without any means. But eventually, I was put into a home because the situation became so difficult. And when the Kristallnacht occurred, my brother was arrested. So again, there was another loss. I wasn't at home at the time when that happened. I was safely tucked up in bed somewhere else. And I also didn't see any of the things which happened on that night. But we were told to go to school the next day. Because I think the adults just didn't know what to do with us. They didn't. They were so shocked mm-hmm. at what had happened. So I went to school. It was a Jewish guild school. And I already had experienced my father being arrested, the problems that we had following that. But many of the children in the school didn't. To them, that was the very first thing that they experienced. And it was pandemonium in school. Some of these children were so hysterical, the teachers couldn't cope. And we had a well in the school and some of the children wanted to throw themselves down. And I think it was then realized that it was safer for us just to go home.
Mm-hmm.
So we were just told to go. But in fact, before we left the school, we all were told two children at a time, a 2 minutes interval, so that there wasn't a whole group of children going home. And on no account to stop anywhere, but run home as quickly as possible. I stopped somewhere. I was very disobedient.
I kind of thought that, actually, Rosa.
There was a paper shop there, and I hadn't known what had happened. And then I saw and read what had happened. And I felt a man's arm on my shoulder. And he said, "This cannot last." But I was absolutely terrified. But he was ashamed. Actually, going to school that morning, I had never seen Berlin as quiet as it was then, before I realized what had happened. So then I ran home quickly.
And your mother then arranged for you to go?
I was told about a week before I was due to go that I would be leaving. I would go to England. And the day before I left, I was told to go to school and tell the teacher I wouldn't be back. So I did that, and I said that I wouldn't be back. And the teacher said to me, "Why you?" I said, "How can you answer a question like that?" I mean, I was aware that everybody was desperate to get out. Mm-hmm. But how can a child really answer a question like that?
No.
It's only about 3 years ago that I learned something I didn't know before. And that was that a German woman wrote a book about the Kindertransporter. And in it, she had said, when she had spoken to some of the older people who were still alive, who had been involved with organizing the transport, that she was told that people like myself were already on the list to be transported. Right. And that, I think, was one of the reasons why I was in the first transport.
And what age were you then?
I was 13 then.
13. And did your sister come over with you?
No. I came on my own.
Right.
Yes.
And how did you find the journey? One of the reasons I was going to ask was my late mother-in-law said that she was 1 year older, and she was asked to she would look after younger children, which she said she wasn't very happy to do. Because she felt she was a child herself.
How old was she?
I think she was 14.
Well, just about a year older than I am. No, we weren't asked like that. There were some adults there who looked after the little ones. But our transport actually was quite different from any subsequent transport. Because I think all of the children on that transport had already been in danger of being transported somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a different type of transport, and also no parents were allowed to come to the railway station, which of course didn't happen in any of the other transports. But my mother, being my mother, she would come, so she came, and she was told in no uncertain terms, "You have no right to be here." And she told them said to them that she has got every right. However, she was the only one who did that, and nobody else came. and we were given our labels and just told to get onto the train.
And am I right in saying that there's a very famous photograph with you appearing as one of the children coming off?
Yes. I think our transport again was quite different. When I listen to other people or listen to their stories, it was nothing like that. As I said already, it's the first transport. Mm-hmm. Was not as well organized. And when we reached Holland, there was nothing really there. Oh, there were one or two women there, and they were handed around some chocolates. I don't remember eating any chocolates or anything like that. We had nothing to eat all day. And I mean, when I listen or read all the stories, it's totally different. But our transport was different. And there was very little organized at that time. I knew that there were adults in the train because just before we reached the Dutch border, we were told that the police would come and search our cases. We had tiny little cases. There was very little that I had in it, and the others didn't have many more. And the adults said to us that on no account must any of you complain if anything is taken from you, and that we must behave ourselves, which we did. So obviously the customs people came and they looked at all our things. It's quite embarrassing, actually.
Absolutely. I think
because there were lots of... we were young people, mm-hmm. and they picked up things and held them up. They were humiliating us, and there was no need for that.
No, absolutely.
And we were very quiet, mm-hmm. very well behaved. We didn't dare say anything. And then just before we reached across the border, then people gave vent to their feelings, and not myself. I mean, I just sat quietly. But some of the boys and girls, and they shouted and they spat on the railways, etc. However, that's what they did. And then the train stopped and they gave us a little bit of food. And then we went straight on to Hook of Holland and just told to get onto the ship, and that was it.
And where did you arrive in England? Which port?
We arrived in Harwich and were taken by bus. When I came off the boat, actually it was a dreadful journey. We were terribly seasick. Bells rang and nobody came. It was really awful. However, we survived it. So when we arrived then, there were reporters there, smile, and honestly, I didn't feel like smiling and I didn't smile. Some of the others did, okay. But I didn't feel like smiling. And then we were taken by bus to a holiday camp, Dover Court Bay holiday camp. And there's pandemonium there. To me, it seemed chaotic to be in charge. You didn't know what was going to happen to us. But eventually we were put into chalets and some sort of order was created. We had morning lessons in English in the morning. And during that time, adults used to come round. It was like a cattle market, looked at children. The little ones were picked up quickly, particularly if they were fair-haired and blue-eyed, but my age group was quite difficult. However, a man came to me during the lessons that we're having. "Stand up, little girl." I stood up, looked me up and down, and then said, "Are you Jewish?" I said, "Yes." We just said, "Sit down." That was it. But it really was embarrassing. And it was also very hurtful. Mm-hmm. And you just felt, who are these people? I mean, how could they do that to children?
Why did he ask if you were Jewish?
Well, he obviously wanted a non-Jewish child.
But were all the children?
No. Well, our group was, but subsequent groups, mm-hmm. there were some mixed children who had Jewish fathers and non-Jewish mm-hmm. mothers. And that also created some problems, because some of these children objected to be classified as Jewish. They had always assumed that they were full Germans and therefore were not part of these inferior Jews. And their behavior was according to that. And eventually, I suppose, they really separated.
So after the man said no, what happened to you then?
Well, actually, because they didn't know what to do with us, I was asked if I wanted to go to Ireland, Australia, New Zealand, I think, and I said no. I was crying. I said, I'm not going there. It's not that I knew the countries, I knew where they were, but I couldn't bear going on a ship again. It was really quite awful, and I said no. So eventually, 13 of us were taken to Edinburgh.
And when you talk about they...
Sorry?
When you talk about the people organising, do you know, was it a government group or was it a group of Jewish volunteers? Do you know who?
I'd be quite honest, at that time, I didn't know who they mm-hmm. were. Mm-hmm. It's only what I read later on, or was told later on, that I understood much more about the organisation.
Right.
At that time, I knew nothing.
Right. So you arrived in Edinburgh.
We arrived in Edinburgh, yes.
And was it a hostel you were staying in?
No. 13 of us were chosen. The Edinburgh Jewish community had agreed to take 13 children. Various families agreed to take a child.
Right.
And they just chose. I take it they asked for the ages of the children, mm-hmm. because there weren't any little ones. I mean, the photograph that I have, I would say the youngest child was a boy of maybe about 8 or 9. And the rest of us were about my age. And Rabbi Dr. Deichers met us with another sort of committee people there. And the only thing that I remember about that episode was Edinburgh Castle was lit up.
Oh,
and it was beautiful.
Beautiful.
Mm. It really was beautiful. And we were then just taken by car to the various families that asked to take us in.
And so you were placed with a family?
I was, yes, placed with a family.
And did you then go to school in Edinburgh?
Well, actually, it was quite a poor family, I would say.
Right.
And I shared a bed with two other people. They were very kind. They really were very kind. But I was crying. I was very unhappy because this was something I found difficult to take. And eventually I slept on the couch in the living room. They didn't have all that many. It was a corporation flat that
right.
they had. They didn't have. But they were very kind people.
I think so, to take you
yes.
in when they
yes.
had so little.
Mm-hmm. That's right. But there was a pussycat there.
Right.
And the pussy shared the couch. And the pussy had fleas. So.
Ah, so you got fleas, yes.
Mm-hmm. So that created another problem for me. I didn't know about fleas, but it was very itchy.
I bet.
However, I was taken away from them and was taken to an elderly couple in Edinburgh. And when the lady opened the door, I was introduced to her, and she looked at me and she said, I really wanted an 18-year-old one, but she'll do. And I became a domestic.
Which is not really what was meant to happen, I wouldn't have thought.
Well, mm-hmm. It wasn't supposed to happen, but it happened. Mm-hmm. And so I became... Actually, because I was still of school age, I had to attend school. And there was another Austrian girl, and I attended the school in Edinburgh. And I must say, I have never, ever seen such bad education in all my days.
In what way?
That wasn't teaching.
Right.
The children were just bullied, you just sat to be quiet. If they talked, they were strapped. And to me, this was unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And we were only there for 3 months, not even 3 months. And the teacher who taught German there was asked to give us something to do. And he asked us to write an essay. So Hertha was the other girl. She was the Austrian girl who was with me. And he said, you can choose any subject you want. And I said, well, I was very interested in Napoleon at the time.
Right.
So I decided to write about Napoleon. But Hertha said, I'm not going to do that. That's rubbish. And she wouldn't do anything. So I wrote my essay, and I felt it was wrong what she was doing. So I wrote her essay as well.
That was very good of you.
Very good. But she got a better mark than I did.
Very unfair. Hope she appreciated it. So you stayed with the family, and was this family the family that you were living with at that time, were they members of the Jewish community?
Oh, yes. Oh,
and
yes.
And yet they still they used you as a meat. How nice.
Yes.
And I'm saying that sarcastically, as you know. And did they have children as well?
Oh, well, they were all grown up.
Right.
Well, they were all grown up. Yeah. So they were only two elderly people. They had, I think there was a man from Lithuania, and he had married a Scottish girl. And they had a room there as well. It was one of these big terrace mm-hmm. houses. Mm-hmm. It was a very big house. It
How
was
did
a
you
very
deal with
it? Lonely time for me.
I think so.
It was extremely difficult. And I didn't meet any other refugees. I was very, very lonely. And I started I wrote a diary. It was the only way I could really had nobody to speak to. They didn't speak to me very much, and I didn't speak very much. I'm not a very easy person. I'm sure I wasn't very easy at that time either, I'll be honest.
And did you know what had happened to the rest of your family? Were you able to keep in contact?
Well, at that time, remember, it was not wartime to begin with. Mm-hmm. And in 1939, before the war, I received two letters from my mother. One letter she had received from the Gestapo. She was told she had to change her name. It was too German. And my mother wrote to me, you now must change, write your name in a different way. And I was terribly upset. And the next letter I got from her was a photocopy from the Gestapo, that unless she and my sister left Berlin within a fortnight, they would be arrested. And I was in a terrible state. So I went to the lady of the house and I showed her that, and I was crying. And I said, you know, what's going to happen to them? And she said, I can't do anything. I've got you. I said, I know you. I'm not asking you. Who can I apply to? What can I do to help them? But interestingly enough, on the 1st of September, 1939, my sister arrived, and she wasn't all that well,
no.
But she managed to get out, and it was the last aeroplane which left Berlin at the time. Maybe not the last mm-hmm. one, but it mm-hmm. was mm-hmm. the aeroplane. But my mother didn't get out.
Did you then live with your sister?
No, I was still under 16.
Right.
And my sister when she arrived and war broke out, she was sent to Peebles, no, Galla Shields, and looked after evacuated nursery children, nursery school children.
Right.
She already had started a nursery, a kindergarten teacher, whatever it was. So she loved that work. So she had always worked with nursery school children. And she stayed there until the area became a prohibited area. And then, of course, the evacuation stopped and the children went back home and she went to Glasgow. But I wasn't allowed. I had to remain where I was.
And how long did you live with this family in Edinburgh till? What age?
I stayed there until I was nearly 16.
Right. And did you then decide that you wanted to go?
Well, it wasn't my own decision. My sister, who was in Glasgow, actually was working in a nursery school which was run by the Church of Scotland. And she, I think, told one of the ladies about me being in Edinburgh. I had a visit from, she was a minister's wife, and she thought I should really come to Glasgow. And, you know, somehow, I don't know how all the arrangements were made, but I certainly packed up my things. I left the family and I came to Glasgow. And that was in March 1941.
And did you live with the minister and
wife? No. I stayed. It was a peculiar situation because I had nowhere to stay. But there was one house in Hillhead Street, which was a district nurse's home. And the lady who ran it, Miss Curry, she was a gem of a person. She took in refugees. Whenever she had any empty bed, you can stay here. So I stayed there. And then I went to the committee, to the children's committee, to report. And I was told I had no business to leave Edinburgh. After all, she said, you had a bed to sleep in. And I said, I think I have paid back what I owed. And I am entitled now to learn something so that I can earn my living. They were very angry with me and wouldn't do anything really for me. But I stayed in the hostel in Renfrew Street, and that was not a particularly nice place. However, it was the minister's wife who then took things upon herself. And she thought I should really go back to school. And initially I went to a primary school. It was a 16-year-old going to primary school. But it was very useful. I learned rudiments of English, arithmetic, handling.
It gave you a good foundation.
It gave me a good foundation. I was only there for a few months, but I learned something. And then she took me to in Pitt Street was the Commercial College.
Oh, right.
So she took me there and they wouldn't have me because I had no secondary school education. And she somehow arranged for me to be accepted to a secondary school. And that was in Springburn. The committee had said, now we'll give you 6 months and then you will just get out and work. However, I went to school in Springburn. And one day I was called to the headmaster. And he said he thought I would be able to sit my highest. Mind you, I was only there for a few months. And I said, you could sit your highest. And I said, I'm sorry, I won't be able to do that. The 6 months are up and I really have to leave. His wife was Bailey Roberts.
Would you like to explain what the role of a Bailey is? What is a Bailey? What is the role of a Bailey?
A Bailey was really a counsellor. at the corporation as it existed in those days. Mm-hmm. Well, it was the council, obviously, mm-hmm. which was part of the council of the city of Glasgow.
So she would be quite powerful then?
Sorry?
She would be quite powerful.
Oh, very much mm-hmm. so. Mm-hmm. I would imagine so, yes. And she certainly arranged a meeting with the Lord Provost.
Right.
And I was taken by the limousine to the city chambers and taken to the room. I had a lovely cup of tea there. And the Lord Provost asked me what I would like to do. And I said I would like to teach. I do know that it's possibly, it's not a possible thing to do for me. But that is really what I would like to do. And he then said to me, my dear, just you continue with your education and don't worry about a thing.
Excellent. However, we do know, Rosa, that you didn't become a teacher.
I did not become a teacher, not a school teacher.
Why did you decide to go into nursing?
When I finished school, I had to make a decision what I was going to do. And the minister's lady suggested I should go into nursing. There were three options: the ATS, munitions, or nursing. And she actually said, you know, I think you should go into nursing. And she suggested that I should go to the sick children's hospital. I should make application there. I was not keen. I knew nothing about hospital life. I knew nothing about the role of nurses. And I could not see myself as a nurse. However, I made my application, hoping it would not be accepted, sent it in, and was called for an interview. And Miss Clarkson, the matron, very gracious, she said to me, now, is there any question you would like to ask me? And I said to her, how long would I have to stay before I could leave?
That must have gone down very well.
And she said to me, Miss Goldsall, if you don't like us and we don't like you, you can leave after 3 months. I said, excellent. So I was accepted. And my whole attitude when I started nursing was really, I hated it. I think I had a totally wrong approach to things. I was also very terrified. Very early on, you had 1 week in classroom, learned the rudiments, how to take pulses, temperatures, and that was it. And you then went into the wards. And the first ward I went to was a surgical ward. And the burns, the smell of burning skin, the crying of the children, I just couldn't cope. I became quite friendly. There were only five of us who started actually the training. And I became friendly with a girl in our group who also hated it. And we fed on each other's misery. And after 3 months, we decided we would hand in our resignation. She wrote her letter, I wrote mine. She went in first. And Miss Clarkson told her to go and pack her bag and go. When she came out, she said that she's leaving. I said, oh, well, this is easy. And I went into the room. And Miss Clarkson asked me to sit down. And she didn't ask very much. But she said to me, I think we should send you to the country branch. I think she may have realised that I was stressed out by the acute areas that we were immediately sent into. But I also knew that I would have to go back to York Hill. So I was sent to Drumchapel, to the country branch. And while there was a senior nurse there. She was such a bubbly person. She was so full of life, so full of fun, and the children loved her. And she sort of drew me out of myself. I was never like that, and I could not be like her. That's impossible. That's not my makeup. But I began to realize that I was wrong, that I really should make a go of it. And after it was 3 months at Drumchapel, I went back to York Hill and just continued my training.
Excellent, excellent. So you became a nurse?
I became a nurse, and actually it was very interesting. When I sat my first finals, the sick children's, and we had oral exams at that time. We don't have that now. And after the orals, the sister tutor said to me, "Oh, the examiners were so impressed with you." I thought, no, that was really quite nice.
I think it's lovely, actually. It's important, I think, to receive praise.
Yes.
So you...
Well, I finished. I wasn't keen to go any further to do my general training. I liked sick children's course, and I enjoyed working at York Hill. I learned a great deal. The training itself was good. Theoretically, I felt was a lot that left to be desired. During my training there, I actually attended a course, not a course, this was a conference on psychology, and I was asked if I would like to go, and I went, and it really was beyond me. My own educational level was relatively low. It was so high-powered, I felt terribly frustrated. But it also stimulated me, really, to improve my own education. I became a staff nurse in York Hill. I went to the outpatient West Graham Street. It was really very interesting there. And after that, I decided to do my general. And I went to Stop Hill to do my general. I didn't like Stop Hill. I did the training. I can't say I enjoyed it, but at the same time, it was a worthwhile experience. And after that, I decided I would do my midwifery training and really enjoyed that.
It's a bit like a bug, isn't it? You know, once you catch that kind of learning aspect, you want to continue.
That's right. I really felt I had to. I realized that with having only a sick children certificate, there were limitations of the sort of work I could get. If I had the experience of adult nursing plus midwifery, it was a much more complete picture.
Absolutely.
I could deal with so many different aspects of caring at the time.
And did you mix with any of the Jewish community at that time, or were you staying in nursing hostels?
Yes, I had no contact with either refugees. Mm-hmm. My sister, of course, at that time, she was allowed to go live in a flat, not a flat, one of the rooms,
in the hostel.
Rooms that we could live in. And she was living with another refugee girl, Jutta, and they were very good friends. But I felt out of it. I was never really part of that very close friendship that they had. And but Jutta became ill, and she developed tuberculosis. And, well, then other events came, because my mother then came, and things really began to change. But at any rate, as far as my own training was concerned, I decided after I finished the midwifery training, I would work as a midwife.
Right.
And I went to Redlands Hospital for Women. Now, it was not a training school. And my attitude was that I was not interested in going to Rotten Row or a big training school. Once you finish a training, you have to consolidate what you have learned and really become proficient. And Redlands, to me, was ideal. You did everything. You had antenatal, you had the labour rooms, you had the mother-child relationship, the delivery of the baby. You worked in every area. And it was an excellent place to consolidate what I had learned. And I became really, I was very fond of it, I enjoyed it. And in between, of course, my mother came. So in a way, I would have to diverge because while I was doing midwifery work, I was then living with my mother.
Because that must have been very emotionally
difficult. It was indeed, yes. My mother arrived. We heard that she was alive. I was still at York Hill when I received two letters. And one letter was from an American soldier, other one from a British soldier, each telling me exactly the same, that my mother approached them at a synagogue service in Berlin and asked each one of them to contact me to tell me that she was alive.
Which is wonderful.
It was tremendous. And they said the letter also, if you want to send any food to them, they would make sure she would get it. So we did that. And then we had a letter from my mother to tell us that she was alive, obviously, and that she would not want to stay in Germany. And we at the time were not sure what was happening to us because we were told that we were only allowed to stay here for the duration and then we would have to go back. And of course, after the war, when Germany was really virtually destroyed, there was a question in the House of Commons. And Churchill was asked, when are the refugees leaving the country? Because people didn't want us to stay here. I mean, there are a lot of issues and things I haven't talked about, but that's one of the things. And Churchill said, you cannot do that. There's nothing for them to go back to. We were told, if we wanted our mother to come, because they were not keen for any refugees to come, we would have to apply to the British commandant to allow, give permission for my mother to leave Berlin. And we did that. And then that was a whole lot of things. We had to promise to look after her, that she would not be a burden on the British government. The people did not require the funds. Both Betty and I were not earning very much. I was earning very little. I was still in training. Betty already was earning £3 a week. So that was always something. And after the war, we also had to get out of our digs because the men came back from the war and
they needed somewhere to stay.
So Betty and I decided, Jutta by that time was in hospital, and Betty and I decided we would buy a flat. We hadn't a penny to our name.
I think that's quite ambitious.
Ambitious was absolutely idiotic. However, we went to a number of places. Was even a bungalow we looked at.
Start at the top, I think.
However, eventually, we had a very good lawyer who was very good to us. Again, due to the minister's wife, who was very, very helpful to us. And also the lawyer who was very helpful to us. And there was this flat in Trefoil Avenue in Shortlands. And we looked at that and it cost £750. We didn't have a penny.
No.
So we said, well, we must get it. But we had to put down a deposit of £100. £150 had no money. So we went to the Board of Guardian, Chief of Us, and ask for a loan. They wouldn't give it to us. And he says, "With no guarantee that you will pay it back to us. We can't give you any money." I could understand that. We were strangers. They really knew nothing about us. We had not a penny to our name, and I could understand it. Eventually, they said, "If you can get somebody to guarantee for you, then we'll give it to you." And there was another refugee, a Mr. Doctor, and he was a marvelous person. And he suggested going to Mrs. Janine.
Ah.
And Mrs. Janine said, "Yes, I will guarantee for you."
She was a marvelous lady.
She was such a good person. Mm-hmm. And she eventually gave work to my mother. She was really a very kind person. So once we got that, we bought the flat in Trefoil Avenue and paid back every month our mortgage. So we had our own flat, but we didn't have much furniture. We used orange boxes for bedside tables and things like that. It didn't matter.
I think to have your own place must
absolutely
have been
wonderful. At least we had somewhere, and we had somewhere where my mother could stay.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, where would we put her? So she arrived in February 1947, and it was really quite emotional. The minister's wife was with us at the station when she arrived at the station. And she was the same bubbly little mother that she always was, full of life. And the first thing she said to us, "I must help you. I must help you," as if she felt guilty mm-hmm. of what had happened. But really wasn't. I mean, she did a lot for us in her own way. And we took her up to the flat. And one day we got a visit from one of a lady. She also had been a refugee, telling my mother how much they did for me. And I exploded. And I said, "And what did you do for me?"
Mm-hmm.
She was very upset, and she walked out. And my mother trying to calm me and trying to calm the woman, but that's how I felt. I mean, as far as the Jewish community was concerned, I got no help from them. Now, I may be unjust because at least they did give me some money so I could pay the hostel until I went into nursing. But it's the attitude
mm-hmm.
towards me at the time, where they're not willing to help me. I felt very upset.
So your mother lived with you, and did she learn English?
Well, my mother wasn't allowed to work.
Because
now, my
of
mother
her
was
status?
Desperate to work. She was desperate to help us as well. And she was also very lonely in the flat, and we were out. Betty was working, I was working, and she was alone, couldn't speak the language. Eventually, she worked, although she wasn't allowed to do it, with the Jewish people who were selling second-hand clothing.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother helped in repairing the things. At least she was with people, and they gave her a few pence, and that was important. But psychologically, she was really suffering. And at the time, we knew a lady, Dr. Winifred Rashforth. She was a psychologist, and she ran the clinic in Edinburgh, the Davidson Clinic, and it was actually that clinic that created the conference in psychology, which I had attended. And it was she who wrote a letter to the Labour Exchange at the time and said, "Unless my mother would work, then mentally she will deteriorate." And then she was allowed to work. She got a work permit.
So you worked in Redlands, and after Redlands,
I worked in Redlands, and then there was an advert that they were looking for midwives in Israel. And I thought to myself, well, that's really where I should be. I should help there. So I applied and eventually went to Israel. I took Hebrew lessons before and I already had rudiments of Hebrew, but not the modern, well, it was modern Hebrew that we were taught in Berlin, but I'd forgotten a great deal. But there was an Israeli student and he taught me and helped me so that when I reached Israel, I could communicate with people. To me, that was important.
Absolutely. And you left your mother and sister?
My mother, by that time, was well established. She was working. Mm-hmm. She was satisfied. She had Betty around her. And she didn't stop me. And if that's what you want, and that's it. So I went to Israel.
Which must have been quite, well, it's quite different in that time, I think.
Oh, absolutely. I went there in 1952. In fact, the plane I was on, it was delayed because Chaim Weizmann had died. And they were waiting for his son from America. And he was catching the same plane to come for the funeral of Chaim Weizmann. So that's the plane I was on. And I actually was supposed to work as a midwife in Israel. And when I arrived in Lod Airport, I had actually been given some car parts. Henry, my brother-in-law's cousin, was in Israel, and they had asked for some car parts that you couldn't get in Israel.
Car parts. Right, okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so I took them with me. I was met by a lady from the Israeli Health Department. And when Asher came, his wife, husband of Henry's cousin, and he said, and where is you, are you taking her? And she said, to Tiberias. No, you can't do that. She needs to be acclimatized first. It can only happen in Israel.
Absolutely. Everyone has an opinion.
So I was allowed to stay in Tel Aviv to get acclimatized, but eventually actually worked in a Sarafand hospital. And when I arrived there, and I said I was wanted to work as a midwife, we don't need midwives. And she looked at my certificate. She says, we need somebody like you for the children's wards. So I said, I don't mind where I work. If that's where you want me to work, I'll work there. And that's what I did. And eventually had two wards. That was 100 children. But it was a very, very interesting, very difficult time, but very interesting time. It was still a time when there were so many survivors coming in. Israel was in turmoil. It was just trying, it had just fought a war. There were tremendous difficulties. They couldn't pay us. And we were just given tickets so we could have dinner or meals in the hospital. But there was a camaraderie there, which perhaps isn't quite the same today as it was then. And it was a tremendous education. It was really quite tremendous. And I remember I had one of the nurses, she was not a trained nurse, had been in a concentration camp. And Achaya just walked round in the ward singing all the time. And some of the young nurses were saying, you know, she's not really pulling her weight. They were complaining to me. So I said, well, how can I help Chaya? So I spoke, I said, let's have a wee chat. How can I help you to make life easier for you? What is the particular problem? And she said, we had so many babies on drips. I mean, some of these babies were really extremely dehydrated. And she said, if these drips stop and the babies die, I couldn't stand it. So I says, look, I mean, I do look after these things. I'm sure, make sure that the drips are running, that there is no swelling of tissue. But if it's easier for you, why not take a chair, take a baby who needs to be fed, and you can still watch the drips And she did that, and that seemed to calm her a little bit. There was another one who was just walking around like a zombie. I mean, the people were really in a terrible state, some of them. The mental hospitals in Israel at the time were full of people like that.
They would be.
But they were trying to give work to as many as possible. And then, of course, there were people coming in from the Yemen, from Morocco. And the area that the hospital was in fact, had a lot of Yemenites and a lot of Moroccans. And it would be quite fascinating to watch how people were actually absorbed and how they themselves contributed in their own way.
So why did you decide to leave Israel? Because it sounded a very exciting
yes,
time.
Yes, well, I was asked to take charge of the maternity hospital in Tiberias. And I was quite interested in that. And then I heard from my sister that she was expecting her baby, it was due any time, that her husband was actually admitted to Crichton Royal. And my mother had difficulty walking due to the problems that she developed during the war. And I felt that I had a responsibility towards them. I couldn't leave it all to my sister. No. That was wrong. Mm-hmm. So I went back.
So you came back to Glasgow, go back into midwifery?
No, I went back into sick children's.
Right.
And became a ward sister at York Hill. And decided that it was really time I moved up the ladder. I was very keen on teaching, that I wanted to do the tutor's course.
Right.
And I went into the classroom and did some teaching before doing the course, which there's an episode there which wasn't successful as far as I was concerned. However, while I was there, I realized I was always had the feeling that the theoretical part of the training, of any nursing training, was really very badly thought through. And particularly the sick children's ones, it was based on a general nursing, and there was no attempt made really to look at the variations, the differences between the child and the adult. And there were no books available on the management or procedures pertaining to nursing children. So I decided I would write a book. That was the first book I wrote, and Miss Clarkson was very encouraging. So I wrote the first and the second edition, but I still felt that my own knowledge was actually so limited that I could not write a book which really encompassed not only basic nursing, but looked at anatomy, physiology, psychology, and all different aspects which should really be included in a course of that kind. But that had to wait until I married.
So tell me how you met Joe.
One day, while I was doing midwifery, I had delivered Mary Finkel's daughter. She had been at Redlands, and I delivered her baby, so she knew of me. Joe evidently was without a girlfriend, so I'm told. And my sister said we were invited out to Mary Finkel. I said, what for? Well, it's quite nice to meet other people, says she. And Mendel was going to take us, because he didn't have a car.
And Mendel was Mary's brother?
Correct. That's right. So Mendel took me and Betty to Mary Finkel. And when we arrived at Finkel's, there were other women there, two other women and a man. And I hadn't a clue who they were. And we had our meal, we talked, and once we finished and we were going home, Mendel said to me, I'm not taking you home, Joe can take you home. I said, why should Joe take me home? I'm not taking you home, Joe has to take you home. So Joe went into his car, no idea who he really was. I was very naive, let me tell you.
Absolutely.
And when Joe took his sisters, I didn't know that they were his sisters, took them home, then took me home. And then he said to me, can I see you again? I said, what for? He says, I'm interested in you. I said, but you're married. I said, I'm not married. I said, well, who were these women? They're my sisters.
And how many years have you and Joe been married?
Well, it was a very, very short thing. Because after all, during that time, he was away doing tropical trials.
Right.
Actually. So I didn't see much of him. I said, oh, well, there's nothing more coming of it. And that's it. Forgot all about it. And then he came back. And then he wanted to continue, which we did. So that year, we actually got married.
Right. And you've been married how long?
52 years.
Which is, these days, I have to say, Rosa, remarkable, which is wonderful. And you have had two daughters?
Yes. But actually, all I can say, I couldn't have married a better person. Not only did he bully me into improving my education, I have rarely met anybody like it. I mean, I have these two children. I went to evening classes, went to Glasgow University, extramural classes. That it was quite tremendous. And then Joe became a counsellor at the Open University. And he said to me, why don't you join the Open University? I said, no way. Couldn't do that. Of course, he said you could. So he bullied me into it.
And so one of the things I have to say, Rosa, is that your book is still in Glasgow Caledonian University.
I think, actually, it is one of the best things I've done. When I look at nurses' books nowadays, I don't find them very informative. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that book, which I had the first and second edition, and which also translated into Spanish and Indonesian Bahasa. I mean, I thought these were really good books. Mm-hmm. Was it covered embryology, covered anatomy, physiology, it covered psychology, and it covered disease processes and nursing management,
which is,
of children.
Which is very important, very important.
And to my mind, there isn't a book like it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not being facetious about
no,
it. I don't really
no.
mean that.
No, I know what you mean. There are, but they're all in different books.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So one of the questions which we always finish with is highlights. When you look back and reflect back on your life, what would you say are the major highlights?
There are so many, actually. I don't think I could say there is one particular thing
mm-hmm.
that influenced me. My parents who influenced me, and particularly I think my father at one point. When I think of the people who looked after me when things really just collapsed, the love that I got from them. These were tremendous, in Germany, these were tremendous people. And the help I got when I came, eventually, came to Glasgow, and all the help I got. And I cannot say there is a single episode that is of greater importance than another. It's mm-hmm. the sum total of it. And not to forget my husband.
Absolutely. I think Joe has been a wonderful partner a wonderful supportive partner for you, Rosa. One thing that we just want to finish with, which was a major input from you, was the founding of SAROC.
I didn't found SAROC. I, in fact, it was Dorrit who founded SAROC. But I helped Dorrit a great deal. I realised early on that Dorrit had problems. And Dorrit came, well, actually she went to the Woogers first and spent some time with them. And the Woogers phoned me and said, would you have a word with Dorrit? She seems a little bit finding things difficult. And yes, Dorrit came to me, and I soon realised what was really the problem. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, Dorrit, I think I'll help you with as much as possible. I'll do X, Y, Z. Oh, good, she said. So she handed everything to me.
But SAROC played a huge part, I think, in bringing a lot of people together.
Sorry?
SAROC, the organisation.
Yes. I think, well, when I took over, of course, things changed. Mm-hmm. From the sort of kitchen cabinet thing, I made it much more organised. I also wrote the newsletter, which was a very chatty thing with Dorrit, which is not the way I do things. So I changed things. And I also, there were a number of problems, actually, because we were not a cohesive group as such. We were not all Jewish. And the programs we made had to cater for different groups. And when people who survived concentration camps came, they also had to be accommodated. We had to satisfy their needs too. And then some of the younger people came. It was actually not an easy group, as far as I could see it, because I was determined that there was a Jewish element there, mainly Jewish element there, which Dorrit, of course, could not understand anymore. And perhaps some of the others objected to it. But I did try to keep us together.
I think I should finish by saying, I know we didn't cover everything, because it's impossible to cover everyone's life in a short time.
No.
But I thought it was extremely interesting and a privilege to interview you, Rosa. And I hope that you found it of interest as well.
Actually, I did. And thank you for asking the questions the way you did them.
Thank you.
Thank you.